This episode of To The Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more details.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey. To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To The Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Frueling, and with me, as always, are...
Suzanne Williamson and...
Kay Shaw.
I'm sorry. I don't know you. Who are you?
Zachary, it's us!
Oh, you I know.
I'm your grandson.
Well, where's my birthday present, darn it?
Oh, it's in the mail.
She hasn't started it yet.
That's like 2 weeks plus however long they have it in customs for.
You waiting till I turn 10? Jeez.
It's a very special present.
Is it a biotemporal chamber?
How did you guess?
Well, if you haven't figured it out, we are going to be talking about the Voyager episode Before and After.
Yay!
I love this episode.
Also known as the Curious Case of Kesemen Button.
Yes! Or, you know, River Song.
Aww.
That's a good connection. You know what I love about seeing old Kes? I love that no one believes her. She's like, why wouldn't anyone believe me? I'm going backwards through time. I don't know who you are. I wasn't here 5 minutes ago. Okay, Kes, you're just getting old.
Yeah.
It's the Morologium. We get it.
What I don't get is how much she aged in 6 months. Because, I mean, Andrew was born. She had her nice long hair, no wrinkles. 6 months later, she's like, decrepit and, you know, short hair, all these wrinkles. What happened? It's the worst 6 months ever.
I don't know. I was trying to understand that because they kind of say, oh, it's the onset of the Morologium. And then maybe they do just kind of like stay young. And then at that point, they just get old really fast.
I don't know. I've had years like that, haven't you?
So like overnight, they wake up old?
Well, not overnight, but, you know, it's faster than we're used to.
Pretty crazy.
I mean, we kind of joke one day you're gonna wake up and look at yourself in the mirror and you're gonna go, oh my god, I'm old. And Kes literally does it. She's like, I'm old.
Yeah.
No, mine is, oh my god, I'm my mother.
Oh wow.
And I've said it already.
Oh gosh. But yeah, it is a bit weird. There's no real interim makeup there, is there? I think that's the point you're trying to make. It's like young, old.
Yeah, but they rocked that old age makeup.
Yeah, she looked incredible.
They did an amazing job.
Yeah.
Even her hands were done so well.
I can't
well.
Decide now. Does Tom have a thing for older women or younger women? It's a little bit of both in this episode.
Both.
That's more maths than I can handle. That's a complex way of looking at it, isn't it?
Depends how you look at it.
I'm just sitting here now thinking about that going, I'm turning my brain inside out trying to work that out.
Don't do that. That could be messy.
How old was she in dog years when they got married?
In Kes years or Compan years?
How old are you in dog years, Kes?
How old are you in Ocampa years?
Ocampa years, yeah. You know, you'd say it's dog years. Actually, there are more Ocampa years to a human year than dog years.
I think each Ocampa year is like 10 yes. years, right? Isn't that about right?
Yeah, because dogs is like 7, isn't
Although,
it?
Although Kes is pretty much fully adult by the time she's 1 year old.
Yes.
Hmm.
Although, no, actually it's more than that. It must be more than that.
So I'm thinking like the first year is like 20 years And then every year thereafter is like 10 years.
Yeah. Because how old do we think she actually is human equivalent in the start of Caretaker?
She's pretty young. I would say, you know, like she's supposed to be like 18 or 20 or something, right?
Yeah, I would say in that age.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, 20 is probably the easiest way to work it out then.
And then when we see her here in this episode as old Kes, she's supposed to be, what, maybe around 85 or 90?
Well, if that's true, then she's doing really well for 85
okay, maybe
or 90.
Okay, yeah, right. It's not 85 or 90. It's more like 75.
I don't know. 75 is not that old. Not anymore.
Well, not these
days. You're only saying that because you're close to 75.
Who are you calling old? Yeah, I was born old. I get it. People have been telling me that my whole life.
I've just gone into a thing of how their aging isn't the same as ours because that doesn't make sense. Because if she ages 20 years in the first year, then she'd be like 180 or something.
Maybe it's like a logarithmic scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it slows down.
And their whole tiny lifespan that they have. It makes me sad that Tom is married to her in this timeline. Because he's not only going to see his wife die, yeah. He's going to see his daughter die, he's going to see his grandson die, all before his own demise.
And in this alternate timeline, he lost B'Elanna just a short time before.
Wow, I don't like this timeline for Tom. Poor Tom.
No, Tom needs a hug in this timeline.
I want to give him a hug.
Everybody hug Tom. Group hug. That, and he's got to deal with Harry as his son-in-law. Bigger hug.
Yeah, that's weird. That's just weird. Like, I mean, I don't... this is something that comes up a lot when this episode gets mentioned. And I don't necessarily find the fact that he ends up marrying the daughter, who's obviously very young, that weird. Because we know that the time span is different and you kind of have to just allow for that. And obviously she's an adult and all the rest of it. But just the fact that he's the father of Tom's grandson is just bizarre.
I have an issue with it because he probably changed Linus's diapers.
Well,
at some point he probably babysat and changed her diapers. Ew.
I try not to think about that.
I wish I hadn't thought about it because I'm creeped out now.
Yeah, I think if you gloss over that, it makes everything better.
Okay, I'm gonna pretend it never happened.
So yeah, I think it's easy to get hung up on that particular point talking about this episode, so let's get it out of the way.
Yes. Over and done.
So I have a serious question about this. What do you guys think that Harry's being Tom's son-in-law would do to their bromance? Would it bind them closer together, or would it introduce some family tension into the bromance?
It would have to bring up some awkward Thanksgiving dinners, at least. Just to know that your best friend is now, you know, doing it with your daughter. That's a little creepy.
Like, that doesn't happen every day, right? It's not like your best friend marries your daughter every day. That's, you know.
No, I think it's interesting to think about how that conversation would have gone when this first came up. Oh, by the way, me and your daughter, etc. I think you see a shade of it, actually, because there's this, the little bit where he actually says, when the baby's first born, when it's the grandson, the son, confusing, is first born, and he says, how does it feel to be a grandfather? Thank you, I forgot his name. How does it feel to be a grandfather? And Tom just says, a lot better than it does to have you for a son-in-law. And there's just look on his face like, I'm still not happy. I'm still not entirely happy about
this. Do you think Harry Kim went all traditional, like asking Tom and Kes's permission to marry the daughter? Like, did he go visit them in the quarters? Did he like call them on the communicators? What did he do?
It's Harry. He would have knocked on the door, rang the bell. And notice he has two pips. In this episode.
Yes, he does.
I didn't notice that, really?
No longer the loneliest Pip.
I've watched this a bunch of times. I've never noticed that. Wow.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Kim.
Yeah, poor Tuvok got a promotion to, you know, first officer.
Yeah.
And he still didn't get to change his uniform.
That's right.
No.
Neelix calls him Commander Vulcan in this.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, still in the yellow uniform.
Poor Tuvok.
They obviously couldn't afford a red uniform for Tim Russ.
Well, Janeway wasn't anywhere to be found. He could have just put on Captain Janeway's uniform.
Imagine how short they'd be on his legs. Like Highlanders.
Well, you know, the replicators were down, so he had to take Captain Janeway's uniform. Like, you know, Captain Janeway's gone. She's dead on a biobed. He's like, give me that uniform. I need that because I got
to
wear red.
Also, I think he would struggle to fill the jacket, to be honest. But anyway.
I don't know. He's got some really broad shoulders, so he might have, you know, tight in the shoulders, like fat guy, little coat.
But it'd be
that type of thing.
It'd be like you know, tight in the wrong places and baggy in the wrong places.
But no, it would be okay. Tuvok would totally do that though, because he had that bad dream about showing up on the bridge naked. He does not want to do that, so he needs a uniform at all costs. He would show up in the tiny That's little true. Short uniform.
But yeah, it is weird. It's weird. It's weird, isn't it, to see the yellow uniform with the three solid pips on there? Because I don't know whether we ever see that ever in Star Trek other than this. It's a bit weird.
And, you know, Captain Janeway's uniform is kind of form-fitting. It's shapely, like Captain Janeway. She's got some good curves, but Tuvok's got the pecs to fill it out, so it's okay.
I think he could just replicate one.
No, the replicators were down. It was Year of Hell, right?
Yeah, but throw Janeway's uniform in and use the energy to make him one. That way you haven't used up anything, have you?
No, they'd cancel each other out, yeah.
Well, no, isn't there some entropy involved? Wouldn't there be, like, some energy loss or something? Like, you can't just, like, recycle a uniform and get another uniform. Like, there's the law of entropy, man.
Yeah, but it's not going to be a huge amount, is it? The majority of it will be...
So it'll still be a little small, is what you're
reused.
Saying.
He can only have the exact amount of energy that was in Captain Janeway's uniform, so it's going to be more tailored for a man, but it'll still be slightly small, yeah. He's going to be tugging his jacket down all the time like Picard.
the Tuvok maneuver.
Yeah.
I have a question about Chakotay's pips, because he's wearing four pips in this. Why did he change to those and not keep, like, his Maquis?
Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it? Because they have the field... Well, what is it? Field commission.
That's brilliant.
Pips or whatever
is there a captain level field commission?
But there's nobody around to give him the field commission.
So he promotes
that
himself?
That is true.
I guess he just rips him off Captain Janeway as she's lying there dead. And just puts him...
I will have your pips to remember you by, Catherine.
No, this is a really important question.
Catherine!
You can't promote yourself inside Starfleet, right? Okay, it's like there's no laws of heredity when it comes to promotions in Starfleet. So if the captain's gone and you're nowhere near an admiral, how the heck do you get promoted to captain? Is it like a democratic vote?
It is a very interesting point.
I'd say he just pulled him off the dead body.
Just like the uniform.
I guess they must have had a conversation about it, but...
they picked names out of a hat.
Yeah, well, maybe, but... I was just thinking, wouldn't it be Tuvok? It'd technically be Tuvok, because Tuvok's the next person in line who's actually, like, a commissioned rank. So, yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it?
But Chakotay used to be a commissioned rank.
That is true. But yeah, I agree. Why did he switch to the official ones rather than the acting?
Well, if you can promote yourself to captain, you can pardon yourself too, so.
Apparently so. Who knew?
Delusions of godhood.
I didn't actually notice whether B'Elanna had her original pips on or not when we see her.
She was dead.
Yeah, but we see her earlier on, don't we, when they've gone back far enough.
But that was before A Year of Hell though, right?
Yeah, but at that point, Captain Janeway's still alive.
Yeah, I know. I was just interested to know whether or not they'd already given them all normal pips before that happened is kind of where I was going.
Oh, you mean in the alternate timeline, but before Year of Hell?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. Because we see B'Elanna for the first time in Neelix's resort program shows up, doesn't it?
Yes.
This was obviously during the period of the resort program.
And that ugly guy's bathing suit with the cutouts on the side. Ugh.
Yeah.
It's like I see him every time it comes on. I'm like, oh God, that is hideous. Please don't wear that.
Yeah. And Kes's like jumper sweater thing that we see her wearing in the future timeline is typically Star Trek weird.
The old Kes?
Yeah, it's typically weird Star Trek, isn't it?
I think I had that sweater.
Amazing.
I'm pretty sure I had that little half sweater.
That's awesome.
I do like Kes's hair. The longer hair.
Yes.
I was glad to see the pixie thing go.
Yeah, I'm team pixie cut.
I like both, but I do agree. The curls look good.
Really, I thought she looked good as an older lady. She looked best in that episode with the gray hair. It was Cougar Kes.
Have you decided after we talked to Manu last week that you're gonna dye your hair grey, and this is why you're now getting all excited about promoting grey hair? Is that what's going on?
Because of Manu's grey hair?
Aha.
Yeah, has he inspired you to dye your hair grey? That's what we want to know.
No, I just like the idea of Kes and Tom. We got Cougar Kes in this episode.
The whole thing's just really weird.
No, that's what I love about this episode. The whole episode is weird. If you just count down the list how many weird things there are in this episode, we've got Dr. Van Gogh, which is weird, and with hair, no
yes.
less.
Yes!
We've got...
Dr. Van Gogh with hair!
I thought he was Dr. Mozart.
Oh, yeah.
We have an Ocampan birth scene. I can see the toes. The sack is
and
opening.
It's coming out of her back.
Yeah. We get two Acampan birth
I've seen those
scenes.
Like baby backpacks that people wear, but she's got a baby back sack.
But why do Acampan babies have humanoid ears?
Yeah, because they couldn't be bothered to do the makeup is the answer to that. That is the genuine answer.
That's just lazy. Lazy, lazy, lazy.
Are there rules against what you can do to like babies on TV with makeup and stuff? Like, Probably. You're not allowed to mess with their ears kind of thing? I don't know.
I have no idea.
I'm making this up as I go.
Unacceptable. Then don't put the babies in there.
I'm not trying to think whether we saw a Vulcan baby with Vulcan ears at one point, but at some point in Star Trek, and I'm just having a blank, but I'm feeling like we saw that.
Well, I know we saw a Tank Denise baby in Alien Nation, but I can't remember.
I guess we saw baby Spock being born in Star Trek 3,
yeah, that's
right?
Probably what I'm thinking of, is it?
With baby Spock ears.
Yeah, we do see that. That's what I'm thinking of.
Except he looked so human. So other weird stuff in this episode, we get the first reference to Year of Hell, yes, and the Krennim and the Chronoton torpedoes. And I know we all look at that now retroactively, go, okay, we know about Year of Hell, we know what these are. But at the time, we hadn't heard of the Krennim and the Chronoton torpedoes, and it was this weird stuff they were cramming into the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was this scary thing in the future.
Yeah, I really like the fact that they do this, actually, this particular episode. And it's... we get some foreshadowing of a few different things. And it's interesting to see that they'd obviously, you know, at least written a chunk of the next season at this point, because it's towards, mm-hmm, this is like, it's end of season three, isn't it? So, you know, a large chunk of season four is obviously already in there. I mean, I think they decided to do this episode because they had some of this stuff in mind for Kes later on, but then obviously at this point they must have known she was going to leave. So they decided they were going to do this episode so they could get it in. That's how I feel. And it's kind of cool. I like the fact that we get to see all of that.
Well, Year of Hell parts 1 and 2 were actually supposed to bridge between seasons 3 and 4 instead of Scorpion.
Yeah, I think that would have worked really well, actually. Scorpion's great, but I think...
Scorpion is awesome.
Yeah, it's a shame we don't get to see them both being a season finale opener, because Year of Hell does feel like it should be one of those.
Yeah, and then 7 takes Kes's place with all the stuff in Year of Hell that should have been Kes. Like, I could totally see Kes assisting Tuvok more than, yes, it would make more sense than 7 doing so.
But they didn't really establish in this episode that the Chronoton torpedoes are used to erase time and stuff. That wasn't really established in this episode at all. We had to wait for Year of Hell to really, mm-hmm, for that concept to be clear, right?
Yeah, we only get shades of it. I mean, obviously we know, yeah, that because it's the Chronoton torpedoes, we get a little hint of the fact that there's going to be time weirdness involved. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I love about this episode, and it's just a little thing, but I love the running joke that the Doctor thinks the biotemporal chamber is ingenious or brilliant or...
that was awesome.
Yeah.
And there's that one little scene where Bolana rolls her eyes.
Yes, the eye roll is the best.
The eye roll. Serious side eye from Bolana.
He does say it in a bunch of different ways, doesn't he? But it's highly experimental, but nonetheless brilliant. and then he says it again slightly later, almost the same. And then at the end was my favorite, when he says, in an extraordinary display of medical heroics. Absolutely beautiful. Oh, he's fabulous. He's fabulous.
Now, do you like him better with or without hair?
Without.
I thought the hair made him seem nicer.
I think, I don't know, he'd just become nicer.
Do you think, was he genuinely nicer, or was it just the fact that he had hair?
I felt like there was a change. Yeah, he didn't feel the same. They definitely felt like there was a progression.
This is like TV Picard and movie Picard. This is like hair doctor or no hair doctor.
Hair doctor. That sounds German.
Hair doctor.
Hair doctor Van Gogh.
Oh, I like Dr. Mozart.
Hair doctor Professor Van Gogh.
I think Mozart would be better. That was great, wasn't it? Dr. Van Gogh, I thought you went with Mozart.
At least you didn't pick Joe.
That is true. Maybe it's Joe Van Gogh.
Joe Van Gogh.
Joe Van Gogh.
Hey, it rhymes.
See Van Gogh paint. See Van Gogh paint. Joe Van Gogh. Joe.
Paint, Van Gogh, paint.
I'm trying to remember. Is it Tom that calls him Vincent?
Yes.
In the episode, someone actually calls him Vincent. I think it's right, Tom,
right. It's right after that. It's right after he says, "I thought you'd gone with Mozart," yeah. And he's like, "Well, I've been doing this study of great blah blah blah," and then Tom says, "Well, Vincent."
What I think is fun is, you know, now when we go back and we watch this episode, we see these alternate futures as really weird because we know how Voyager really did turn out over its 7-year run. Now we look at this episode and we can see the writers kind of projecting what would Voyager be like in a few years. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally plausible projection of what Voyager could be like in a few years. It didn't actually turn out that way, but I think it's remarkably plausible what we saw in this episode, most of it.
Except for Neelix being security.
Well, I was just about to talk about that, actually, because... I agree. I don't think security necessarily works for Neelix, but I think I would have liked to have seen him get into a Starfleet uniform at some point. I know it's something he would have liked to have seen.
I could see him doing ops.
You could see him do that. Maybe he could have been
plasma manifolds.
Counselor. Ship's counselor.
Counselor.
But Neelix has been trying to get security training from Tuvok for years, tactical training, right?
Yes. How did he wear him down, though? What made Tuvok change his mind?
They had a personnel shortage after Year of Hell, right?
Yeah.
But then who's running the kitchen? Somebody's got to run the kitchen.
Maybe they fixed the replicators. They solved the replicator ration problem.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, Neelix still had to make the Jim Bailey and fudge cake, though.
That's true.
No one else
can't
do it.
Can't be without
Neelix.
The Jim Bailey and fudge cake. Come on.
No, not if there's a celebration go on. You need a Jim Bailey and fudge cake.
Absolutely.
And now I really want a slice.
No, really, you can't see Neelix as a security officer or a tactical officer?
No, I don't think that's his, he could probably do it, but I don't think that's his strength. I think he'd be stronger in other areas.
Mm. Definitely.
He's better as an ambassador.
Yeah, I think he'd be stronger at something else.
Where do you see him? If he's not going to be an ambassador, Chief Neelix?
Transporter room chief.
Okay, no, seriously, though. So if he can't be a tactical officer and he, say, where he's not going to do the ambassador thing because we're in an alternate timeline and we've ruled out transporter chief, what else could Neelix do?
Clean plasma manifolds.
He can do that without a uniform. I think he could have been counselor. I think he was good at that.
I think Kes would be better.
She would, but given the fact that she can no longer be on the ship or it'll explode...
That makes being a counselor a little difficult. You have to go to her.
It does make it a little bit tricky, yeah.
She doesn't do house calls.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he's not going to be working in engineering with B'Elanna, right?
No.
I can't see Neelix doing that.
No, not at all.
Do you think Neelix is either Andrew's or Linus's godfather?
Probably.
Probably Linus's.
Yeah.
So I guess in the episode, she's Linus... Kim, right? She's married to Harry, but she was born Linus Paris.
That doesn't flow off the tongue very well.
It doesn't
well,
terribly
Paris.
Well, does it?
It's like a defective rhyme, Linus Paris.
Yeah.
It's not as good as Joe Van Gogh.
I think of her as Linus Kim, but really she was Linus Paris.
Yeah. Assuming they gave them surnames and it wasn't just Linus.
It could just be Linus, but like Kes is just Kes, right? So
and Neelix is just Neelix.
And Tuvok is just Tuvok.
Chakotay.
And Chakotay is just Chakotay.
Chakotay.
There's not a lot of surnames on.
No,
on
there
Voyager,
aren't. There aren't
it.
A lot of surnames.
I never thought about that either. And yet they still use Mister. You still get Mister Tuvok and Mister Neelix.
Seven of nine, I suppose. Yeah, Of is her middle name.
Of is her middle name.
They don't call Kes Miss Kes or Mrs. Kes or anything, right? It's just Kes. But you do get Mr. Tuvok and Mr. Neelix.
Well, I don't know. I kind of think of that more as a respect thing or a conveying of a title rather than it being that's your surname, your Mr. Tuvok. It's like it's kind of like an officer thing. I don't know.
But the captain gets called Sir.
Only in crunch time.
No, never Sir. Ma'am in a crunch.
Ma'am and a crunch.
Ma'am and a crunch.
Otherwise, Captain.
Yeah. Or never Catherine.
But Kes never gets any sign of respect. She's just Kes. She's not Nurse Kes. She's not Medical Assistant Kes. She's not Miss Kes. She's not Mr. Kes. It's nothing.
Kes.
Just Kes. Yeah.
Like Madonna.
Yeah.
It's like Madonna.
Or Cher.
She's
take it either way.
What? like Madonna, Elogium for the very first time.
Oh my gosh. Oh gosh.
But Andrew is Andrew Kim, right? Because that's clear. He's...
Yes.
I think he's that way in the credits. On IMDb, he's listed as
Andrew. Okay, Kim. I didn't look at that. That's interesting.
But Linus is... Okay, I'm curious now because I didn't look at Linus so
Let's
much.
Let's look that up then.
Okay, yes. So, Linus Paris. Oh, well, there we She go, is cited then. As Linus Paris.
Mystery so solved.
It's not just Linus. It's funny they chose to cite her as Linus Paris as opposed to Linus Kim.
Maybe they weren't
that
married.
Is a little weird.
Maybe they weren't married. That's a good point. This is the 24th century. They're progressive.
But then he still referred to Harry as son-in-law.
He does. But then I think people do that even if they're not married now.
No, it's just interesting. It's not just Linus. I had kind of assumed it was just Linus, but it's Linus Paris.
It is interesting. I find it interesting as well. And this isn't just about this episode. This is just generally an observation about Star Trek. Whenever we get mixed race... or mixed species people who are part human, it's always the other species features that are dominant that seem to hang around, and we see this because obviously like Andrew's only a quarter Ocampan, and yet he's still got the ears and everything. Yeah. And I find that quite interesting.
You're saying humans generally have recessive
yeah
genes
that's how it seems
races.
Anyway, and I don't know whether that's just because human features are not that distinctive compared with all the other species that we see, but it's certainly something that I've observed and I find quite interesting. They do seem to dominate for a number of generations.
It's not just like a dominant recessive thing, because sometimes they blend together, like half Klingons don't have like all ridges or no ridges. They have like half ridges.
Yeah, they do, and I agree with that. But if we see like future Maral, for example, she looks almost the same as B'Elanna. She's not less. She doesn't look less Klingon. They're quite. You know, that still continues to show up.
And she's only a quarter Klingon.
Yeah.
Doesn't she? It's a little bit less, though, isn't it? Isn't it?
I don't think it's significantly less. If it is a little bit less, it's not obvious. It looks very similar to me. As Suzanne just said, she's only a quarter Klingon, so. But I think that does get referred to, actually. I do think they refer to the fact that Klingon facial stuff is dominant.
She got half the ridges, she's a quarter Klingon, but she's got the full attitude. Got it.
But it is interesting that even once you've got three quarters human genes in there, that they're still very obviously... I don't feel like in this episode in particular, like Andrew, I don't think his ears look any different to Kes's. They look the same.
Doesn't Linus say that Andrew has Kes's nose?
Yeah, I think she says that. But an interesting question that I have about this as well, which I don't think, well, there's no way to answer it really, but...
I never stopped us
before. Well, once you've got someone who's half a camp and half human, what is the lifespan then? Is it longer or...
I was thinking it would be longer. It wouldn't be 9 years. It'd be like 18 years or 15
so
years.
So Linus would live longer
something.
And then Andrew would probably live even longer because he's only a quarter of Campan.
That's what I had assumed. And there's no way to answer this.
No,
right.
There
That's
isn't.
That's what I was thinking.
It's interesting to think about.
It's the forehead ridge problem all over
it
again.
Is. It's interesting to think about, though, because it's not something that gets mentioned. And obviously they never actually end up existing.
You think they would have mentioned it in the episode? Like they would have mentioned Linus lives, you know, not 9 years, but 15 years. And Andrew's
well, maybe they don't know because they've never had it before, have they?
Yeah. These are the first human Ocampan hybrid.
Yeah, so they probably don't know.
And Joe Van Gogh makes quite a point of saying that there's no other Ocampan on board for uses a control or a comparison, right?
Yeah.
The birth scene, I can see the toes, is just hilarious. It cracks me up, but... It's like, I can imagine sitting around in the writer's room like, okay, how are we going to have an alien birth scene that's different than a human birth scene? Well, it can't come out, you know, where it usually comes out, so it's got to come out the back. And it can't come out head first, so let's go toes first. Okay, let's just 180 degrees at every step of the way.
Why couldn't it come out head first?
That's not how they do
it.
Well,
I think they were just trying to make it seem
and
alien.
No, because some human babies will come out feet first. Breech babies,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So is this an alien birth or is this a breech birth?
When we see Kes's birth, they don't really say anything about that, do they?
They don't say anything, no.
I do like, though, the fact that she says, I think one day she'll see the sun. Oh, so I'm a sap. I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's a
that
great point. Sweet. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Because she doesn't only just see the sun. She travels the stars. Yeah. She's amazing.
I thought that was a really lovely little moment, actually, yeah. when her mother says that. I thought that was really nice.
I think that's amazing of anyone who does great things, actually. I'm serious about this. Like, you know, the Neil Armstrongs and the Buzz Aldrins, you know, they're going to be the ones who walk on the moon. Kes is the one, you know, in her world that leaves the planet and travels the stars. She's amazing.
Well, it's not even leaves the planet, is it? It's like goes to the surface of the planet. That's a huge thing for them.
I love the dad's reaction when she tells her story, like, "Oh, I was on this starship and blah blah blah," and he thinks
she's
just
playing a game,
playing a game or telling a story.
That is what you'd think, though, if a kid told you that. I think, isn't it?
Well, no one believes her. Like, you know, no one on Voyager believes her. Her dad doesn't believe her when she's a little kid. No one believes Kes in this entire episode.
But like, if a kid told you that, you would think they were just making up a story, wouldn't you?
First time a kid yeah. tells me that, I'm whipping out my tricorder.
Whip out that tricorder.
Check for chronoton particles.
Check it for chronotons.
Are you temporally displaced?
It does kind of sound like a kid game, though. Like, "Oh, Daddy, I'm infected with chronoton particles. Okay, let me pull out my tricorder and I'll check you for your chronotons." You know?
How many wrenches are you at right now?
Yes.
Yes.
Is that a real unit? I don't know this. Is that a real unit of radiation? Are wrenches a thing?
Only time I ever remember hearing that in Star Trek.
Well,
so
there are we hear rads. That's a real major yes. major of radiation, mm-hmm. radiation, right? Yeah. We hear that in The Next Generation, I'm pretty sure. Mm. I don't remember which episode, but we hear, you know, the ship is nearby some radioactive thing and yeah. they're talking about how many rads of radiation. Okay. But wrenches, I've never heard that one. I don't know if that's a real thing, but now I have to Google it.
Well, I don't think it will be because it's to do with chronotons, isn't it, which aren't a real thing.
Well, I don't know. Let's
see. Well, they're an extension of the ideas of quantum physics, aren't they?
Oh, you know, I have a thought about this. Do you think that maybe wrenchen is a bad pronunciation of röntgen, like röntgen rays, like x-rays? Okay, we have an answer, folks, listeners at home. Wrenchen is actually spelled R-O-E-N-T-G-E-N, which is röntgen, like röntgen rays after the guy who discovered x-rays, right?
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
So they're just mispronouncing röntgen.
I think it sounds better, though.
Wrenchen sounds way cooler.
It does. Or maybe because it's not supposed to be exactly the same thing, they took the word and then pronounced it and
they
then consciously tweaked it. Yeah.
Now I'm going to be scared to death every time I get my teeth x-rayed or my body x-rayed. I'm going to be thinking they're sending me into the past and time will unwind and it will be utter disaster.
No, I'm traveling backwards through time again.
But you'll keep getting younger, so that's a plus.
That's true. Until it gets to the point where you don't exist anymore.
Where you're just that cell and then poof, gone.
Yeah.
This might be the answer to the question we asked our associate producer, Bruce Lish, about 24th century dentistry. Maybe it is actually chronoton-infused dentistry and it reverse ages your teeth.
That is perfect. Mystery solved.
I'm gonna wrench and ray your teeth.
Quick, message Bruce. Tell him we fixed it.
We solved it. We fixed it. We're dental packlets. We fix things.
We fix things. I do have some more questions, though, about the metaphysics of this episode. So when she's traveling back through time, you know, when she actually jumps, we see her kind of phasing in and out. I found that a bit weird because I thought she was just jumping back to an earlier version of herself. So when she jumps, would she not?
I saw it being more like a quantum leap.
Yeah,
you know, she's jumping into her past self, quantum leap style.
They didn't see any difference in terms of like her visually. Yeah. Like it's not like she would have vanished because their Kes that should have been there would have still been there. She just jumped into the body. Mm-hmm.
It's weird though because every time she jumps, she has more of her memory engrams, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because she doesn't know anything about anything at the beginning of the episode when she's old and she has less than
1%. Well, that's because she's learning with each jump. She's learning about the future.
Yeah.
Well, she also, but she knows more about the, about, it's hard to, like, I want to call it the past, but I'm not sure that makes any sense in this context.
She does know more about the past, but I think that's because of what people have told her. Because, like, when she runs into B'Elanna for the first time, she's like, "Oh, you must be B'Elanna." And then when she goes onto the bridge, she sees Janeway. She goes, "Oh, Captain Janeway." And Janeway takes it as a, "Oh, she's come to tell me something," but actually what she's doing is going, "Oh, yeah. you must be Janeway."
Oh, so I see. I think I misunderstood this. So you're saying she doesn't actually know who those people are until she encounters them and then it all makes sense for her.
No, she's just assuming.
Oh.
Yeah. She sees them, and then because of what she's been told in the future, she thinks, oh, that must be the person that they've told me about.
I guess I had assumed that when she went back in time, she had all of her memories from that time period.
No,
so
I don't think so.
Things in that time period made sense for her.
No, which is why she's so confused when it gets back to the caretaker episode. Then she's there with Neelix and like, the heck is going on here?
Yeah.
And that Neelix was a jerk in that scene.
Neelix was a jerk in that episode.
But he's like, don't mind her. She's never been like this. She's crazy. Keep us on the ship, please.
That was horrible, that line. I thought that was really like demeaning towards her. Oh, she's never been like this before. Like, whoa, hang on a minute. First of all, she can speak for herself. She can speak for herself, first of all. And second of all, that is treating her quite a lot like a child at this point.
I mean, we know that Neelix has a blind spot when it comes to Kes, but he's just a jerk in this scene.
Yeah,
in this episode.
He is. I didn't really like the way that scene was done. It felt a bit, it was quite uncomfortable.
And it wasn't the most natural reacting of that scene, because they're reacting a scene from Caretaker.
Yes.
And I don't think Ethan Phillips did a spectacular job of capturing the intonation and the vibe of that scene in this episode. Maybe it was intentional, I don't know.
To make it feel a bit weird. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really listen to him so much because you're more focused on Kes, I guess. I'd have to watch the scene and pay a bit more attention to Neelix, because I think my brain just kind of glosses over Neelix because I'm like, oh, he's just doing what he did in Caretaker. So I kind of just fill that in without really watching it, if you know what I mean.
Well, one thing that it was so weird, and it seems so forced, that it almost seemed like before you get the reveal that they're actually talking to Captain Janeway and they are actually in the past, it almost seemed like they were in Neelix's quarters, like practicing, like rehearsing that speech to give to Captain Janeway. But no, then the camera pans back and they're actually right there with Captain Janeway.
Yeah, I do see what you mean. It's odd, isn't it? Because you see it from the opposite camera angle to how you see it in Caretaker, which makes it feel weird
as
well. Yeah,
it's almost like he's practicing in the mirror, like, oh, then, you know, you will anticipate your needs before you even know what they are, so please keep us on board. Okay, let's go tell that to the captain for real this time.
So, yeah, I think the way that the metaphysics works when she's actually jumping back and stuff, I'm not sure that works quite right. I think that the time travel episodes, as much as I love them, any kind of time wearable episode I love, because I just think that they're really interesting. I always feel like the metaphysics, you don't need to pick at it too much, because it's always a bit loosely put together.
Well, we can. I mean, insofar as the future is usually somewhat dependent on the past, right? Mm-hmm. In the normal flow of time, that's how the future works. Right? The future is dependent on the past. But in this case, Kes gets popped out of the future because she does her little time jump thing. And then she's in the past, and the past events have changed. So is the future kind of wiped out and it becomes a moot point at that point? Like, at the end of the episode, they say this is just one possible branch of futures. So is does her time jumping just wipe the whole thing out and make it a moot point? Because she's changed the past.
The past is the future. The future is the past. It all gives me a headache.
Yep. I love that quote.
Weirdest part of the job.
Yeah. I guess the way I think of it is when she jumps, like after she's jumped back from that future, if that future ceases to exist, it doesn't matter. But if it doesn't...
Right, I guess that's
my
point.
But,
right?
But at the end, when they're talking about it, like, oh, you end up with all these branches suggesting that all those different bits of future did end up existing. And then it's like, what happened after she jumped away? Did they get the other Kes back who was then like, what's going on? Or...
But just because there are multiple possible futures doesn't mean they all are actual and they all really exist, right? They were alternate possible futures. They weren't necessarily actual futures.
But there is a theory, isn't there, where every possible future exists in its own.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's not the only theory of time, right?
No, it's not. But what they say at the end suggests that that is what they're saying, because they say, oh, you know, all these different branches came off from it. They kind of imply that they do think that every single one of those bits that we see then ends up being a branch in its own right, which is quite interesting.
I guess the question is, just because there are possible ways that the future can unfold, does that mean those are actual and they really exist and there's actual people in those timelines, or are they just sort of hypothetical, you know, abstract constructions that don't really exist in any meaningful metaphysical way?
Well, like you said, it depends on which theory of time you want to go with.
I'll go with the Back to the Future Part 2 time period. I need hoverboards, people.
The thing I do find really interesting, though, is that this future timeline that we see stems entirely from a slightly different outcome of Year of Hell. And I find it interesting that so B'Elanna and Janeway die, and also Carey they mentioned as well, although we don't actually see him, but they mentioned that he dies as well.
Poor Joe.
How does it must suck to have your character killed off when you're not even in the episode.
How many times has he been killed off? Several times. Once, actually, several times theoretically, but then that happens to quite a few people in Voyager, but anyway. But I find it interesting that what then happens in order that they remember the timeline? That's the bit that I don't get, because then in this alternate future, they obviously like fix the problem with the Krennim. Maybe they just get out of the space or something without actually dealing with the time ship, because they all remember that it happened, and obviously everything that happened is still a part of that continuing timeline. I found that really interesting.
You lost me a little bit. Who remembers that it happens, and when do they remember?
Anybody that reads Cass's report would know what happens.
What I mean is, in the future timeline, there's no reset button in Year of Hell, so everybody that it continues on from the end of that.
Right.
But also, as a result of that, as Suzanne just said, although they don't remember everything about Year of Hell, they still have this bit. They still hear about it from Kes. So even though it gets reset in the actual episode, they've already heard that it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, isn't it?
That it is. Yeah, is there any consequence from that? Like,
I don't know. Well, they don't find out a lot about it. They know the Krennim exist. They know about the Chronoton torpedoes. And they know there was quite a lot of damage to like the ship and stuff.
But when the actual Year of Hell happens, even though there's a reset button at the end of it, do we see that they had any foreknowledge of the fact that it was going to be Year of Hell as a result of Kes's experience here?
I don't remember if there's actually a reference to it in the episode.
Yeah. That shot of the torpedo inside the Jeffries tube, that is an awesome piece of set work. So they want to milk that for all it's worth. So
yeah,
any chance to talk about the Chronoton torpedoes. It looks cool. I would want to reuse that if I were making Voyager. But it sounds like you want a tighter connection between these two episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's what we're looking for. I think I feel like there ought to be some kind of, there should be more foreknowledge. So when they show up, they should know more about their technology, and they don't seem to. I know it does get briefly mentioned, but not as mentioned as it probably should be.
I could kind of picture Tom Paris and Chakotay aboard the Krennim ship, and they say, "We've heard great things about your one bottle of wine from the civilization that doesn't exist anymore. We heard about it from Kes, so break open that bottle and give us some of that wine."
Yeah. The thing is, do they actually run into the time ship in that timeline? They run into a Krennim ship, but is it that one?
It's not the time ship.
It's not, is it?
Because it's nowhere near.
Oh, it's not
big.
The time ship. Right.
So maybe they don't even run into the time ship, and that's why the timeline ends up being different going forward.
Just random run-of-the-mill Krennim ships that are still Chronoton-based, but not the Chronoton time ship.
Yeah.
Not the one with red on it.
Or the Federation president.
The Federation president.
Yeah.
What's he doing on this side of the galaxy?
Yeah, that was
done something different with his hair.
And his forehead.
He's like, now they're going to save the galaxy again by standing trial. Or by ceasing to exist or something.
But there are a lot of things you can pick at with this episode. It's interesting to pick the little bits out of it, and it's quite fun to kind of go, oh, isn't it interesting that they had this timeline where they got past the Year of Hell and they still all remembered it.
I think, you know, that future timeline looks pretty good. You know, the Doctor's got hair, he's got a good
attitude.
Apart from
Janeway and B'Elanna being dead.
Yeah, that's not so good.
Yeah, well, okay, that's true. There are some bad stuff. There's going to be a lot, as Chakotay says, there's going to be a lot of grieving to do. But life is like that.
I think it would have been a cool future timeline if Janeway and B'Elanna hadn't been dead. But then presumably if B'Elanna hadn't been dead, then Linus and Andrew never would have existed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of miss seeing Neelix seething over, as much as bothersome as it is to see how jealous Neelix can get about Kes, I kind of want to see like jealous, crazy Neelix in this episode about the fact that Kes
He's got over it though by that point, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Is that because he's hooked up with a Klingon woman or something? Like what's going on with Neelix? Who's keeping Neelix warm at night?
Somebody from the resort program.
Yeah.
Some hologram.
He's got a Klingon in a bikini.
So, yeah, clearly Neelix has got over it, but, it's interesting that he's got over
it. I think it's nice to see that he's got over it, actually.
It is nice.
I liked the fact that we saw that he'd gotten over it. I also thought it was interesting that we got... Because Tom and B'Elanna are not together at this point.
No, they're not.
This is prior to Day of Honor, isn't it?
But mm-hmm. Tom did say that B'Elanna was very special to him.
Yeah, but they kiss.
Mm. This is another thing that gets somewhat foreshadowed, because I think... You can see where it's going with the two of them before that point, but I think this is the first time that we get this, yes, it's definitely going to be a relationship, because this is really the first time we see them actually together, a couple-y. I know it's in the future, but...
I'm actually surprised people aren't more sad about the fact that Captain Janeway's not around. They just kind of gloss over. They say there's going to be a lot of grieving to do and whatnot, but... No one seems particularly upset about it.
It's quite a jump, though, isn't it?
We didn't get to see that part, because I'm sure that happened.
How far does she jump at that point from the one that we see afterwards? It's a number of months, isn't it? So it's not going to be...
I guess I just assumed that, Captain Janeway was killed right before the Year of Hell scenes that we did see in the episode.
I guess, but during the actual Year of Hell, I don't think anybody's got any chance to really be upset about anyone being dead.
That's true.
Because it's all just so much about trying to survive.
I love Chakotay's just like, I'm sorry, there's too much going on. I can't deal with your time-traveling weirdness right now.
Yeah.
I ain't got time for this. Nobody got time
sorry,
for this.
Sorry, I've got other stuff to worry about. Can't deal with you and your weird time-travel wibble. Never mind the fact that it might actually fix the problem, but... Never mind that.
And I love that Kes is like, okay, I got it. I forget what she says, but she's like, I know, I understand. You got bigger things to worry about. You haven't time to deal with me right now.
Yeah.
You're right, Kes.
I still have to steal those pips off of Captain Janeway. I don't have time for this.
And Tuvok's got to steal our uniforms.
Yeah. Steal it and
talk about grave robbing. Captain Janeway's barely cold, and they're stealing her pips in her uniform.
Well, she's not going to need them.
Nope. Poor Captain Janeway. Another one of her many, many deaths. Add it to the list of
and
deaths.
And B'Elanna's first.
Yeah, that's true. B'Elanna doesn't die that much, does she?
Like 3 or 4 times, I think.
Did you guys think that Andrew Kim was a little like 1950s, golly gee, grandma kind of Leave It to Beaver portrayal?
He was very Beaver Cleaver.
But Harry's son would be like that.
He would.
He just would. I thought he was cute. I thought he was.
No,
cute.
I'm not saying he wasn't cute. I'm just saying it just was a little, it was a character.
Golly gosh, Grandma.
Golly gosh, Grandma. Yeah, exactly.
Let's have some tea and watch the Waltons.
Good night, John Boy.
Good night, Kes. Good night, Harry. Good night, Chakotay. Good night. Joe Van Gogh.
Good night, Catherine.
The one other thing that I did want to talk about was actually the relationship between Kes and Tom that we see, because it's lovely. I think they're really, really sweet together in this episode. There are some really nice moments.
It's like they're walking a fine line between being newlyweds and between being an old, charming married couple.
Yeah, and I think there are just some really lovely moments, and the relationship totally convinced me. I don't know whether it's Robert Duncan McNeil's skill as an actor, but he sells it. He really sells it. I totally, like, even though Kes and Tom, I know there's been little bits of, shades of them that have happened at other points in the series, but he sold it to me totally. It wasn't something that I saw really as a couple. But he, I totally believed it.
Later in Voyager, when Tom and B'Elanna are together, we get to see Tom's growth as a character, right? He turns into a loving father and husband, and we see all that. But this is back in season 3, and we get to see a caring husband version of Tom way before we get to see Tom and B'Elanna Tom.
Well, yeah, but it's the same Tom at the same time in the future, isn't it? Because we're seeing the projection of
that's
that.
Right, that's true.
So
yeah,
it's obviously the
right.
Writers had decided that that's where they were going to take him. And yes, it ends up being B'Elanna and not Kes. Mm-hmm. But it's clearly that's where they were going to take him to. That was his growth arc. But there are just some really lovely bits. I love the bit when she says that she doesn't remember him and doesn't remember being married to him. And he says, I've got enough feelings for both of us. I thought that was gorgeous.
I love that. I always go like, oh, yeah. It's so sweet when he says that.
That definitely gave me the warm fuzzies.
Yeah.
I like when he sits down and asks Kes, are you ready for another episode of Kes and Tom, the early years?
I know. That was really sweet as well. Really lovely. And there's some really nice stuff as well when she's behind the force field in sick bay and she's phasing out and he's getting all like, no, don't go.
And they're trying to touch each other.
Yeah, they were very, very sweet then when he's got putting his hands up on the force field.
Which, shouldn't the force field have zapped him?
Yeah, but they didn't quite touch it, didn't they? Artistic license. For a romantic moment, I am prepared to let almost anything go. So yeah, I just felt like we should have a little mention of that because it really worked for me, even though it's never something I've seen in any other episode and gone, oh yeah, Kes and Tom, but he totally sold it. I think it was him particularly that sold it, because she's doing the whole confusion thing and she doesn't really have that much, because she doesn't remember the relationship, so you don't get it as much from her side, but from his side I really believed it.
Well, as much as I like Tom and B'Elanna, I'm not a hardcore Tom and B'Elanna shipper. So I actually like the sweetness of what I see with Tom and Kes. You know, Tom and B'Elanna have kind of a quasi-antagonistic, you know, inflammatory passion for each other. But, you know, Kes and Tom were pretty mellow, pretty chill together in this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they do.
I thought it was a good match.
They do suit each other quite nicely. Yeah.
Until she, you know, disappeared and he screamed and... The mime acting in those kinds of scenes always crack me up because they haven't done any of the special effects yet. Like, if there's going to be a force field, the force field doesn't exist yet. And if there's going to be a vortex, the vortex doesn't exist yet because they haven't done it in post-production. So they have to kind of do mime acting for those things. I like that.
Yeah.
Did you ever hear William Shatner describe what it's like to act in a science fiction movie?
No.
Yes.
He said they would paint a X on the wall and he'd say, okay, that's where the monster's going to be. And we don't know what it's going to look like yet, but you have to act really afraid. Go.
Yeah. It must be difficult. There's a lot of skill to that. An awful lot of skill to that.
Like, when you're acting, she's going to phase out and there's going to be this vortex and there's going to be this force field thing and now emote.
Yeah.
Good actors can do that. So if you guys start weeping on command, you know, weeping randomly, I'll know you're just rehearsing for your future stardom. That was like the most British sounding fake cry I've ever heard. I'm just saying.
Sounded like something from Blackadder or Monty Python. I could hear myself sounding like Hugh Laurie. Fake crying in Blackadder. Oh.
Well, you guys, it's been fun talking about the Okampan life cycle, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And basically, we had this bonding experience where basically all of us cast members were like doing jumping jacks and push-ups in between days because we were trying not to get frostbite. And I just remember Benedict said something. He's like, I wonder if I can get a beer here while I'm, you know, like, so it's like, JJ, is there a tap I can attach to one of these and we can maybe keep warm a different way?
Literary Treks.
When it comes to these early novels, when they're written in a first season, they don't always match up well with what we learn of the characters as the series progresses. Like, for example, I think the first couple books or so, The Next Generation, there's scenes where Troy refers to Will Riker as Bill.
Melodic Treks.
So what you're saying, if I understand correctly, so let's say that there was a 2-minute piece of music and it was played in 5 different episodes. And each of those episodes had a different part that sounded the best. So you may have spliced together. Wow!
Continuing mission.
You know, we were pitching our idea, Don and I, to the folks at Starbase Studios. And I vowed to myself that I wasn't going to walk on the bridge and then go sit immediately in the chair and have a picture taken of myself. However, as soon as I got on the bridge, I sat in the chair and I took a picture of myself. So it was like a kid in a candy store.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and now also on Google Play and YouTube. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you can find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We have some people that we'd like to thank. We would like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Matala, our Patreon manager. We'd also like to give a really big thank you and a shout out to our associate producers here on To The Journey, Bruce Lish, Ju Kim, and Norman Lau. Thank you for your support of Trek FM and of To The Journey.
Don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and get your seat on the mission. Also check out audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
If you want to get in touch with us, there's lots of different ways you can do that. If you go to our website at trek.fm/contact, there's a form there. You can look in the sidebar on our To The Journey show page on the Trek FM website to leave us a voicemail, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. On Twitter, we're at trekfm. On Facebook, we're at facebook.com/trekfm. Whilst you're on Facebook, check out the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners only group. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of To The Journey on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. So Suzanne, when you're not becoming father-in-law to your best friend, where can people find you?
You can find me occasionally on Facebook in the Babel Conference, just hanging out. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is at KJaneWay8. That's the letter K, Janeway, and the number 8. And Zachary, if people would like your recipe for a Jimbalian fudge cake, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the Trek FM network as co-host of Metatrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. You can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruling. And you can find me in the Babel Conference if you want to talk about Star Trek with me there. And Kay, when you're not visiting sickbay trying to get your Rentgen or your Röntgen levels down, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference. And if you want to look me up on Twitter, my handle is ChocoWeeble.
Well, everyone, join us next week and we'll be traveling back in time to the point of our own conception. But until then, this has been To The Journey.